Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. I'm laughing, Malcolm, because I almost gave you this week off also by the time I got to you this morning, so I apologize for that.
You still have a lot of time to do tshuva.
That's true. And it's only the first show of the year.
So I'm going to add another al chet.
So I hope to certainly demonstrate that tshuva. You know, it's amazing to see, and I'm so curious your reaction to this. The Prime Minister of Israel is in this presidential race now because no matter how one conjectured that he as Prime Minister wants one candidate or the other possibly to be president, not to be president, etc., now he's being shown in certain ads in certain states. Do you think this crossed a certain line?
It does, in making a commercial and utilizing the Prime Minister in this way, and I think he has gone out of his way, and especially past Sunday on Meet the Press and on CNN and elsewhere, trying to make clear that he does not want to interfere in the election, that he is discussing an issue of great importance, of great moment, and that there are maybe differences in terms of the timetables or the approaches, but not on the principle and not in terms of the ongoing U.S.-Israel cooperation. And he tried to distance himself from involvement, but obviously everything that happens now in America is seen through the lens of the political silly season, and the Prime Minister has been dragged into that as well.
Yeah, it's been a crazy week on the political silly season. By the way, can this now escalate? Can we see certain groups and those who pay for ads utilize the Israeli Prime Minister to an even greater extent, or is this going to be the limit?
No, it's not the limit. I mean, people, because you have so much money being spent, hundreds of millions of dollars on all sides, and people taking advantage, especially in, let's say, in Florida, where a few percentage points switch can make a big difference. And because the race is so close, that people will exploit everything and every issue, not just the Prime Minister, but I think all issues. Mr. Romney invoked the Prime Minister, quoted the Prime Minister. The President has spoken about his relationship with the Prime Minister, with Israel.
Right.
So Israel, though, should not be a partisan issue. Israel should be a consensus issue. Iran should be a consensus issue. We don't want to see this be politicized and then there be ramifications after the election with bitterness, with people on one side or the other feeling that they were slighted. This is not the way it should go. Israel has always been a bipartisan issue. It should be so today.
Yeah, but when someone like yourself calls for more of a concentration on foreign policy, isn't it difficult when it's a bipartisan issue? Isn't it difficult to make it into a bigger issue during a campaign? Because campaigns really are about debates and differences between candidates.
Well, people have to give their worldview. Candidates have to say how they would address some of the critical issues. Even when we look at the uprisings in countries around the world, 30 people have been killed already in demonstrations over this silly film, and which nobody has seen, and was not the cause of the events, as I said last week, and
right.
Now they're catching up to it. This was these were planned attacks for other reasons, and now the film has taken on a life of its own, even though, as I said, none of the people who are demonstrating have any idea what it is, or certainly it was not something authorized or sanctioned or approved by the government or anybody else that we know of. I think it's this crook who wrote it while he was in prison and probably tried to raise money on it. But, how people address these critical issues are important. It's a test of leadership. It's a test of, the directions that the country will move, because we're going to face more and more tests in the coming months and years.
What's more dangerous, to be a French newspaper printing cartoons or to be an American posting movie trailers to the Internet?
I think they're both pretty dangerous, and after you do it, you take off.
You disappear, huh?
You try to disappear, but the real chutzpah of this guy passing it off as an Israeli Jew first or an Israeli American, and himself being a copt and a marginal one, not representative of that community either, it could have potentially had much more severe consequences for our community.
Right.
As it is, you see the intensity of these demonstrations that are continuing till now.
Was there a report about a bombing in France?
Yes, there was outside a kosher store, and there was a bomb left there, and they broke the window, and they said it was the aftermath of the video, but you know, these things happen in France.
Right. And who knows what the real reason is.
You know, the French Muslims now are trying to urge calm because you've had demonstrations there against a newspaper that published, also a marginal newspaper that published a satirical publication.
Right.
That had those cartoons.
You mentioned demonstrations, and so Pakistan, which saw anti-American demonstrations this week, right? So is that
today too?
Is that the first time in a while? Is that like
no? The demonstrations. The only surprise was that it took so long because Pakistan is explosive. There's a lot of anti-American feeling because of drone strikes, because of other things. A lot of sympathy for the Taliban, which, as you know, was born in Pakistan,
right?
Not Afghanistan. And it's a very tender situation where you have, in all these countries, large unemployment. And remember, the numbers of people actually involved in these demonstrations are relatively small, with the primary exception that I've seen so far is Beirut, where 500,000 people came out on the urging of Hezbollah, and Nasrallah himself addressed it and used it as a platform to touch on, you know, retribution to Israel vis-a-vis Iran, etc. But that was amongst the biggest. In most of the other places, they've been smaller.
So Cairo, Gaza doesn't even come close. None of these places come close to that.
No, and Libya as well.
Right.
It was just much more violent.
Why did it take the White House so long to declare it a terrorist attack, the one that killed the ambassador?
Well, I think that they were caught off guard, although we should not have been, because there were warnings. There were both in Egypt and, I think, in Libya. That it was retribution for the killing of the Al-Qaeda leader who was from Libya. And this was too coordinated, too well organized, that there should have been some warning. And the question is, why wasn't there more security at the embassy? It is a terrorist attack. It should be declared so. It's not, you know, this constant reference to the film. I don't understand, because we see that this has broader basis, and we should declare it for what it is. And at the same time, they can acknowledge that this film has nothing to do with the American government. You know, many of the countries, the people don't believe in it. They don't believe that the United States government can't outlaw it, as they do in their own countries, outlaw everything. But they don't mention that their governments produce films attacking Jews in Israel and distorting history and maligning Christians as well. That they overlook and conveniently bypass.
Are any American diplomats in the Middle East safe at this point?
I think all of them are under additional security, and rightfully so. It's never fully safe in a region of such turmoil, but it can happen anywhere.
Two terrorists, I assume, killed in Gaza yesterday, right? I mean, these were more attempted infiltrations. The IDF had to take them out because they wanted to carry out terror attacks against Israel.
Well, they were actually involved in planning a major terror attack, and they have, one of them was involved in many attacks through Islamic Jihad. And today there was another incident, in fact, I think it's still going on, where terrorists shot from the Sinai. They detonated an explosive device on the border near the Arif Mountain, and Israeli soldiers killed three of them. But I understand that the helicopter gunships are still involved in some exchanges of gunfire.
Yeah, I mean, I know we always bring this up, but I don't know if it could ever be overstated, especially this time of year. We're praying for the security of our people, you know, for the next year. It reminds us again, and thank God the IDF is there, but it reminds us again that there's constantly an effort to get into Israel and terrorize Israelis.
There are constantly efforts. One of the reasons I think we see less is because of the strength of the IDF. It is a deterrent. They know what it means. I think that were it not there, you would see what's happening between Muslim countries, let alone what they would do to the Jewish state. I think Israel today is in many ways in a stronger position given the regional lineup. It's not something we take for granted. It's something that has to be constantly be on the vigil and make sure that it's strengthened and Israel's military edge is always expanded. But you see that the countries are so involved in their internal issues, and especially all the things we saw this week vis-a-vis Syria and Iran, with Syria testing missile systems for chemical weapons, with the gas shells at this research center near Aleppo. and these empty shells were fired as a test, and there were the IRGC, the Iran Revolutionary Guard officers, flown in to observe it, to participate in the exercise. And Assad, according to information from a person who was in charge of the chemical weapons program who defected, had plans to transfer weapons to Hezbollah. So the fears that Israel expresses that sometimes people are skeptical about are all too real and all too legitimate.
You know that Assad, I don't know if he was quoted, but the but commentators have said he will only use chemical weapons as a last resort, Malcolm.
Well, he would use them, but that he's talking about it against his own people, I think, and against, you know, perhaps against the rebel forces. But in this case, when it comes to using it, if there's an attack on Iran or something, whether they would use it. And the more dangerous situation is not that he uses it, but that it is stolen or vectors. And in this case, the United States has been working very hard together with countries in the region to try to prevent it and be ready for any instance. But it's hard to monitor when you're talking about so many locations.
I hope my sarcastic tone was noticed and noted. It's America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program. Heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, around the world on the web, jmnam.org, and the jmnam.org online network, which is rolling all day long. Information about the weekly update podcast. What could be better than a weekly update podcast? Go to jmnam.org. A homepage news section contains information how you could have the weekly update delivered to your iTunes each and every week automatically. Could you go through the schedule with us? Because I know this coming week, it's a very big week in the Jewish world, but it's also a big week in terms of the United Nations. I'd like to know the president's schedule. If you could tell us the prime minister's speaking schedule, especially if it includes the United Nations, tell us what's happening this upcoming week.
Well, there'll be a lot happening because we'll have the first thing I can predict is traffic jams. That, you know, in New York, it's crippled, especially during the time that the president will be here, which is likely to be Monday night. I think he is speaking on Tuesday, but I know he will be here Monday night, and Tuesday he'll be flying right back to Washington.
Shach Medinajad speaks on Yom Kippur itself?
On Yom Kippur.
Are you serious?
Yes. And there's
Come on, Malcolm. Give me a little symbolism here. Come on.
There is some irony in it. I don't think there's any symbolism when it comes to Ahmadinejad. And Netanyahu arrives.
But listen to this. I mean, this is an unbelievable image. The Jewish world will be in the fervor of the highest prayer moments of the year, and their greatest enemy, he himself declares himself the greatest enemy of the Jewish people, is going to be speaking on the world stage at the same time. That's unbelievable.
And perhaps not coincidental.
Right. I'm sorry, you were saying the Prime Minister.
Not accidental. Right. The Prime Minister, because of Yom Kippur, can't leave until Motzei Yom Kippur, which means he arrives here Thursday morning.
Right.
And will be here having meetings, I assume, with Hillary Clinton and Ban Ki-moon and others. And then we'll leave Motzei Shabbat back to Israel for Sukkot.
And does he address the UN?
He addresses the UN on Thursday, probably around 1 o'clock.
Uh-huh, wow.
And in addition, we have the opportunity, this is, as always, we're going to be meeting with many, many heads of state and foreign ministers. It's still interesting to see how many of them want to have meetings, even though we're very limited because of Yom Kippur and the amount of time we have for them, but we have literally scores of meetings that will be coming up. And they're very important because it's an opportunity to make the case, especially given the issues, the seriousness of the issues, Iran being number one, two, and three, but the you know, Israel security, the events in the Middle East, there are so many important issues that this is an opportunity for us to make the case, and especially when we see that there are many in the international community who seem to be getting wary or tired of the Iran issue, the fact that 120 of them showed up in Tehran, and now Ahmadinejad, in his speech, will come and speak as the leader of the non-aligned movement, the 120 countries, and will focus on the Tehran meeting, which shows that Iran, in their eyes, is not isolated, and that will be his, I think, his major address. I think Bibi, in his comments earlier this week and over the last weeks, has really moved the issue front and center, and I think part of his goal is to activate the international community, and we will see how many of them show up when Ahmadinejad speaks, how many will stay away, and those who are there will walk out when he starts his usual diatribe, which we can more or less count on him doing. I don't think he'll disappoint us. What I think it was important is that Netanyahu also seemed to set the deadline as 6 months from now,
right?
Not for action, but for when Iran will have crossed, and that you have to draw the line before that. As you know, there is a difference about between the United States and Israel over whether the marker has to be set when they have a weapon or when they're capable of making a weapon.
Right.
And he pointed out that he thought by summer they would be 90% of the way towards being able to make it. We also saw other attempts this week that sabotaged the two of the Natanz and the Fordo nuclear operations, and the word of the flame, the malware affecting their computer operations at the places. But at the IEA this week, they again talked about resuming talks, and that they met with Kathy Ashton, the EU foreign minister, and said that she's going to go back and talk to the P5+1. But the Iranians said, and then it'll take a month for us to resume the talks. So what they've done successfully is each time, buying time, they try to shift the onus to Israel again by having this international conference on a denuclearized Middle East, which Israel said they would not participate in. But they did say, for the first time, that they would welcome inspectors from the IEA visiting their nuclear plant and checking its safety. And they said they're not concerned. They think it will meet all international standards. And this is, Iran, which is suffering huge inflation, 25 to 50%, hundreds of thousands of people unemployed, none of that bothers them. They're selling more oil, they claim, because of all the countries we've given waivers to are now rushing back and still buying oil from them. We've seen the actions in the Persian Gulf, where the 26 countries had an exercise this weekend, and the Iranians launched another submarine, which they refitted, back into the Persian Gulf, where they have three or four of them already operating. So there's a lot going on this front, and I'm afraid that people, after all this time, begin to withdraw. We see the Russians said this week that there's no grounds for continued sanctions. So Russia is playing the usual duplicitous game, but it's a very high stakes.
Can any rabbi get up this Wednesday and not mention Iran at some point?
Well, I think what's disappointing is, and I've gotten many emails about it, is how many rabbis over Rosh Hashanah didn't talk about Israel.
Yeah.
And to think that either they're intimidated or they don't think their congregants will be interested in it. I saw a video that one rabbi of the Reform Synagogue who gave a remarkable speech, Ami Hirsch, but he talked about it. And he said, we can't be intimidated and silenced because people aren't comfortable with something Israel does or what they perceive. And not to talk about Israel, and to also said that we can't give a place to those who question Israel's right to exist.
All right, Obama.
Others would do it.
Obama Tuesday. Excuse me for grouping them together. Obama Tuesday, Ahmadinejad Wednesday, Netanyahu Thursday. I guess it, in all seriousness now, for a moment, because we always speculate about why the president would or would not meet with the prime minister. It looks like, all along, he was on the front end of this trip, while the prime minister, obviously because of Yom Kippur, is on the back end of the trip. So I guess that logistically, one could say it didn't work out.
Well, first of all, the president will be long gone before the prime minister gets here.
Right.
And he had very little time.
And he's campaigning. I mean, seriously,
Bibi had very little time for it. And he offered to go to Washington, but the president is campaigning. And
right.
So I don't think this was a slight. I don't think people should make a bigger issue out of it and try to paint it as a slight. People are saying, he has time for other things and not for this. But I think that
we should. I know what you mean.
There are real issues.
Right, there are real issues. He does have time for a lot of very interesting things this week. Malcolm, I'm not suggesting that you are or are not supporting this, not supporting this. People are frustrated. That's why I'm doing it during this segment. I hope you don't mind. People are frustrated about the lack of the ability to hit the streets and demonstrate against the nuclear Iran. So I just want to mention that there is going to be a rally this coming Thursday meaning the day after Yom Kippur, everybody. A lot of folks are at work in Manhattan. This coming Thursday, 12:30, schools that can participate, that'll be great. Thursday, 12:30 at the Israeli consulate. It's a rally against the nuclear Iran and a rally, obviously, in support of Israel. 42nd Street, 2nd Avenue, an opportunity for people to come out, especially because of the calendar. And I don't know if it would have happened anyway, Malcolm, but certainly because of the way the calendar is set up, there has been no massive, you know, effort to hit the streets for obvious reasons. So I just wanted to mention that Thursday, early afternoon, there will be an opportunity for those who want to take part.
There are, and there are also online petitions. There are other expressions, but the and demonstrations, I think, at the Warwick Hotel by students. But one of the things is that that Ahmadinejad is going to be off the scene by the end of this year, certainly as president. His
right.
term is over. He can't run again.
Right.
And part of the idea now is to show that it is not Ahmadinejad, because people will say that he's gone now. You know, we have to take a new approach. We have to give him a new chance. We have to see. It's not true.
Yeah, like Egypt
system,
and everything.
It's Khamenei. Yeah. It's the supreme leader. He's giving the orders. They're driving this. They're talking about Rafsanjani being the prime candidate to replace Ahmadinejad. He's the guy who was implicated in the attacks in Argentina. I mean, this is not some tzaddik coming in here and going to have a clean slate. So people should understand that we got to take the focus off Ahmadinejad, because we made his face the symbol or the emblem of the problem, when it is in fact the whole system that is driving this nuclear program and the anti-Israel positions.
All right, you got to tie up some loose ends here. So what's going to happen this week with the UN and the PL and the PA? What's going to happen this week?
It's going to be interesting to see. He's speaking, I think, on the 27th, so it'll be the week after. That is Abbas. He's coming here for 10 days. He did tell people in Ramallah before he left that they should look for a new president, that he, you know, but it's a ploy he's used before. So it's not something that is new. It is unlikely. He will not declare a UDI, a Unilateral Declaration of Independence. He will declare his intent to pursue it, and it's likely it'll be in the General Assembly, not in the Security Council, because he still doesn't think he has the 9 votes. Even though he would risk a U.S. veto and embarrass the United States and seek to isolate it, but I think he did promise the administration he would not do anything before the election. At least he has indicated that. So you will get a very tough speech and a strong declaration by him, but not the actual move directly for a vote on a unilateral declaration.
Wow. So the speculation is wrong. Because most say that, I shouldn't say most say, but many commentators are writing that he'll take the extra step and go for it this week.
In November, December, if it suits his purposes at the moment. And also, I think he may not go for it if he doesn't have the support of the WEOG, the West European and others, meaning the European Union. He knows he won't have the U.S., but Australia, others, if without their support, if you don't have the major countries, he may hold off. And also, you know, he saw the price that Clay paid with UNESCO, and there are a lot of people who are telling him, don't do this because it'll force the United States to cut aid to him, cut aid to the UN again, as they did cut off UNESCO.
So the UN is not always just a numbers game. Sometimes you do need certain countries to be on your side.
Right. You don't. He can pass this automatically.
Right.
He can get the 120 countries who showed up in Tehran will
right.
vote for him. So the automatic majority is there. But it's the question of what is the quality of the vote that you get on this.
Hmm.
And when he went into UNESCO, he had only gotten 107 votes. It was not what he expected. They expected to get 135, so he may be a little bit more gun-shy at this time, but it's not altogether clear. He also has to look at what's happening in Gaza, where there's talk about separation, where you're seeing more connection between Egypt and Hamas, with Hamas being allowed to open the office, but at the same time, Egypt taking certain steps against the smuggling, against other things, not because of Israel's security, but because of their own security. And that relationship is a complex one, and there are people who even say that maybe if the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, takes a greater role, they'll become, you know, like an adult supervisor for Hamas.
Yeah. What do they call that? The chicken... The fox guarding the hen house?
The hen house, right.
I can't think of these phrases. Yeah, thank you. You feel free to use it. What does Erdogan mean that the richest Jew in the world came to negotiate a deal between him and Israel?
It is not true. There was a visit by an active Jewish person. He's not the richest Jew in the world. He went on his own. It had nothing to do with the government of Israel. They didn't know about it and were not involved in it. Now there's speculation about which one is the richest Jew in the world. So they started throwing in new names. Erdogan said this in answer to a question about the relationship with Israel, and he was saying, look, they approached me, and my answer is still the same. You got to meet my conditions. Whether that will change, there is a very interesting development overnight, and that is that Erdogan canceled his participation at the United Nations. This is very interesting, I think.
Meaning he's not showing up?
Workload, he's not showing up. And that to me is very interesting. We'll have to see more about what really is behind it. Turkey obviously is on the front line with Syria. There's a lot of pressure building in Turkey amongst the people because of the influx of refugees, the economic burden, etc. And I think maybe he doesn't want to be away. People always speculate about his health, but I think he just did a very heavy trip to 4 or 5 countries, so it seems that he is recuperated from his illness.
Why do certain members of the United States Congress believe that the President and Secretary of State want the blind sheikh released?
I don't know, but I certainly hope there's no truth to it. I think it would be simply outrageous to let this murderer and terrorist go. I think it would send completely the wrong message. You only invite more and more incidents, and we know from the lessons of Jewish history that we don't give in to this because you just will set up the price for every other terrorist that is being held. We know that in the demonstrations, that is one of the things that they use against their own governments to demand the release of terrorists, and they have with Israel as well. And succumbing to it doesn't generally help.
The information out of Cairo confirms that was one or maybe the primary reason for these demonstrations, trying to secure the release of the blind sheikh?
No, that wasn't the primary. Remember that he has a lot of followers amongst the Muslim Brotherhood. It was one of the demands of those who were planning this long before, not from in the aftermath of the film or of the demonstration at the U.S. Embassy. For those who were working on it for a long time, this was, for them, one of the primary demands that they want to make. Remember that, 75% of the people in Egypt do not believe Arabs carried out 9/11.
Wow.
75%. So, you're talking about a very different mindset and context, and in that they have elevated the blind sheikh. And remember, the Egyptians are looking for tremendous debt relief from the United States. Congress is now holding up some of it and probably won't deal with it until the next session. There are a lot of new mosques being built. Saudis are building them in Egypt, others, and they're talking about privatizing. And that means they're going to fire 100,000 government preachers. Under Mubarak, they used to get a weekly memo with what they were to talk about. Now, you could have a very different situation where then the preachers would have to justify their continuation, but it also means that the Muslim Brotherhood will be in a position to take over many more of the mosques.
Wow. Finally, Malcolm, we always wonder, obviously, about the strength of the U.S. military, Israel, of course, versus foes like Iran and whoever else, God forbid, might be in the future. Now I see this report about the cyber attacks, that Iranians are being blamed for these cyber attacks on banks. Is the enemy getting as good at this cyber activity as the United States has been?
Well, I mentioned some months ago about Iran setting up a special unit, very large unit, focusing specifically on cyber attacks, both on defense against the attacks, and, there is word that the flame virus, which is, I think, an offshoot of Stuxnet, has been infecting various installations and businesses and others in Iran, including obviously targeting the nuclear, but not just that. And cyber warfare is going to be increasingly a major means of conducting war. People who think that it means just, poisoning somebody's computer are wrong. You could shut down all the electric grids. You can shut down entire systems. You can get missiles to misfire. You can do a lot of things by infiltrating the internet and the systems within governments. They can be protected, but it seems every system can be overcome. So Iran is definitely involved in this, and they're doing it globally. You know that Israel is the most attacked country in the world. There's 1,000 attacks every hour of every day of every week. And Israel has to work all the time to monitor them and to try to counter them, and those that are more dangerous to really work at it. But Israel also has the capacity, as was demonstrated in the past, to utilize its scientific advances and knowledge for good purposes.
There are 1,000 attacks every hour?
Every hour. Now, some of them are, you know, minor. A lot of them come from Belarus, come from, you know, all sorts of weird places, but yeah.
So Israel, we always think of Israel, you know, fighting on four fronts. The cyber world is more than just a fifth front.
Well, we're fighting on many fronts. The economic front, with this attempt by Fayyad to have a boycott, and the delegitimization campaign, which is getting a short shrift now because we're all focused on Iran and on the political system season and all of that. But we should not overlook the continuing efforts to spread the boycott of Israel and to engage in this tagging of products from the West Bank, which is interesting because Fayyad, the prime minister, who's supposed to be in charge of the economy, is the one leading it, which will cost the jobs of 10,000 Palestinians who work in the West Bank. And the mayor of Maladumim told me that alone there are 3,600 Palestinians working. They get the same pay as Israelis. They go back to Ramallah, they get, you know, $200 a month as opposed to $1,500 a month, and most of them will be unemployed. So you're just going to set this up for more violence. This is a short-sighted thing, and we're demanding that the European governments and others hold them to account at the time when they're complaining they don't have money, and largely because of all the corruption, and Israel has been trying to help them to stabilize it because they don't want to see the collapse of the PA. For them, this tagging business and the other efforts, are very serious, and you don't want it to spread then to other products and become acceptable. Once you accept the principle that you can do it, it becomes then more and more widely practiced.
It becomes the norm. Malcolm, we're going to be standing there Wednesday. We're going to be saying special prayers. I'm thinking specifically of the Avinu Malkeinu toward the end of Chazaras HaShatz, which we say more than once on Yom Kippur, asking God to eradicate every category of bad things that could possibly afflict us. And at the same time, the greatest enemy of the Jewish people, who openly and proudly wears that label, is going to be speaking on the world stage.
But just think of the power of our tefillos, and if people remember that we don't pray for ourselves, we pray for the collectivity. You know, I think I once quoted Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal said, and it's in his Machzer, that if the nations of the world knew how much we pray for them, they would buy us the Machzorim. and people should remember that we don't just pray for ourselves and our personal needs and do a Cheshbon and Nefesh personally, but the collectivity, and that is the key. As all in the Vim and the Haftorahs that we read, it always comes back to the message of the unity, of the essential elements of unity amongst ourselves, that with time when you have all the political issues and everybody being divided and we emphasize divisions, not come together, we should remember Ostreicher, we should remember Rubashkin, we should remember Pollard, we should remember those who are in difficult circumstances, the Jewish communities that today are facing difficulties. And I must say, today at the UN, I'm going right now, we have a big program there for the first time on reminding the world about the plight of Jewish refugees from Arab countries, when 900,000 Jews were chased out in a deliberate campaign, coordinated campaign by the Arab states, and we have all the evidence of it, that it was deliberate, the laws passed from one country to another. So we want the world to understand there are two refugee issues. Yep. It doesn't mean anybody else's claims. This is a historic injustice that has to be corrected.
Yep.
And also one other thing, that there was an amazing article by a professor from Los Andes University in Bogota about a subject we've been talking about, and that is about Hezbollah in Latin America.
Right.
And the tremendous expansion of their activities, which we'll talk about in a future time.
Unbelievable. Malcolm, an easy fast and a meaningful Yom Kippur, and we'll update you and everybody regarding our schedule for the rest of the holidays. Have a wonderful Shabbos, and thanks for joining us.
Have a good Shabbos.
There he is, Malcolm Hohnlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Podcast information, go to jmnam.org. Information is in the on the homepage in the news section. Weekly update podcast information. Assuming Malcolm's available, and I believe he is, we'll certainly be on 2 weeks from today, which is Erev Shabbos Chol HaMoed. In terms of next week, we'll let everyone know exactly what the schedule will be here at JM and the AM as we try to fit in everything before we get to the holiday of Sukkot.